This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that the Supreme Court has ended its term, reporters and legal scholars have been analyzing how the court was changed by the appointment of Clarence Thomas. My guest, Timothy Phelps, is the co-author of the new book, Capital Games, about the behind-the-scenes politics of the Thomas nomination and confirmation. Phelps played an important part in the process. He was one of two reporters who broke the Anita Hill story, which resulted in a second set of hearings. His article revealing Anita Hill's charges of sexual harassment went on the wire service the evening before Nina Totenberg's interview with Hill was broadcast on NPR. Phelps covers the Supreme Court for New York Newsday, and he paid special attention to Thomas's first term on the bench. He wasn't surprised by Thomas's judicial opinions.
Not one bit. It was clear to me from doing the research for the book, basically, from reading everything that Clarence Thomas had written or spoken in a great volume of speeches, that he was much further to the right than he had been portrayed by the White House during the nomination process.
Mm-hmm. Are there ways that you feel the Bush administration manipulated the press?
I think the press was very much manipulated in this whole process. I think that we were kind of suckered into the what they called in the White House the pinpoint Georgia strategy, the bring yourself up by the bootstraps from racism and poverty angle, along with the seeming contradiction of a conservative coming from that background. And while that was an interesting story, I think that we in the press missed the real stories here, which is the extent of Thomas's ideological radicalness, and also not many people did a very good job in investigating Clarence Thomas's associations and who he was connected with.
In your research for your new book, did you find out anything that you didn't know before about how Thomas was chosen?
Oh, absolutely. From the accidental to the planned, there was a couple of weeks before the nomination, Clarence Thomas happened to be running in a charity foot race here in Washington with Boyden Gray, the White House counsel, who has the largest role in picking nominees. And they got to talking about quotas and affirmative action and found that they had a great deal of common ground there. And so that helped on one front. On another front, we found that Clarence Thomas's ties to the religious right in Washington became very important for him, because John Sununu, the chief of staff of the White House, called judicial point man for these groups here in Washington a few hours after Thurgood Marshall resigned and said, "Who do you want?" And the answer came back, Clarence Thomas.
Now, this isn't a standard thing to do, to call a special interest group and say, "Who do you want?"
Well, it certainly has never been known as being standard before. But this president and to some extent President Reagan in his last term have kind of given these nominations to the far right as the price of their still sometimes wavering support.
What ties did Thomas have to the far right and to the religious right?
Well, we found that in recent years, starting from about 1986 to 1987, that Clarence Thomas had given most of his speeches to groups of the far right and had close personal connections with organizations like Library Court, which is a coalition of pro-life, they call it pro-family organizations with a very conservative social agenda. He had gone to meetings of these organizations, and they had come away well satisfied that he would be a representative of their political agenda if he got on the Supreme Court.
Special interest groups always mobilize around or against the nominee. Was there anything unusual in how the right mobilized around Clarence Thomas?
Well, The right was ready for this one. They got outmaneuvered in 1987 with the nomination of Judge Bork. And while so much attention during this nomination process was paid to the liberal opposition groups opposing Clarence Thomas, the real action we found was on the far right again, where they were spending a war chest of money that they had been amassing ever since 1987. Pat Robertson's organization, The Evangelist, alone spent perhaps $1 million on television ads and other techniques to raise grassroots supports for Clarence Thomas.
You say that Pat Robertson's group, the Christian Coalition, has ties to Clarence Thomas's church.
That's right. It's interesting. Most people thought that because of his background, having been raised by nuns, that he was a practicing Roman Catholic. In fact, he was attending a church in suburban Virginia, an Episcopalian church that is a charismatic church and is also happens to be the national headquarters of the Episcopalian Right to Life movement.
Hmm. Do you think more should have been made of that connection between his church and the Right to Life movement during the hearings?
It was a very difficult call for the press because, quite naturally, in this country, we're squeamish about paying too much attention or raising too much of a fuss about someone's religious connections. I mean, we all have freedom of religion. I think that probably more should have been paid to it in a careful kind of way because, after all, Thomas was saying that he had no position on abortion.
Timothy Phelps, let's get you into the story. In your book, you write, "Rumors are unpleasant to deal with, but I have no apologies for scrutinizing a Supreme Court nominee's private life." Why not?
Well, Supreme Court nominations, I believe, are different than other more political posts here in Washington. A Supreme Court justice is appointed for life. And not only that, but their moral authority is really the way in which they help lead this country. And to the extent that they're of poor character, it diminishes the authority of the court and its ability to do its job.
When you say that you had no apologies for scrutinizing the nominee's private life, what were you looking into about Clarence Thomas's life? I mean, one of the controversies had to do with whether he watched a lot of pornography. Was that something that you had heard rumors of, and did you pursue that?
That was not an issue at that time until Anita Hill's testimony. I would say that I would not look into questions about pornography in most situations. I think that actually is a private matter that has no bearing on his service on the court. It only became important after Anita Hill's allegations when she said that he had insisted on discussing pornographic movies with her. The first rumor I looked into, and I wouldn't bring it up here if he hadn't brought it up himself later, was a rumor that the Clarence Thomas had been beating his wife, his first wife. And as far as I can tell, this rumor was unfounded. At least there was absolutely no evidence that it was true, and there was some evidence that would tend to point the other way. But while this is a personal matter, I wonder if it had been true, would women want a person sitting on the Supreme Court who was abusive? Now, but I would like to make a distinction here because the charges, the allegations made by Anita Hill were not personal allegations. They were allegations that something had happened in the workplace. And it's what Clarence Thomas tried to make it sound like this was about his private life during the hearings. They were about what happened in the workplace between an employer, allegedly, and an employee. And in fact, in the offices which are charged with enforcing the laws against sexual harassment.
Now, what are the obstacles to you as a reporter of running with a story like this? I mean, you knew about the charges, but you couldn't just write an article about it.
Right. I felt during the summer that I couldn't write a story saying that an unnamed woman had made charges of sexual harassment about which I did not know the details. I felt it was important to have a name attached to these charges and that person's account of what had happened. When Anita Hill actually made a formal complaint, as it were, to the FBI in a sworn statement, then that raised the level of the allegation to something that we could use.
Mm-hmm. Initially, you couldn't call up Anita Hill and ask her about the charges because your source gave you the information under the condition that you not call her and ask her directly about sexual harassment.
That's right. I eventually did call her several weeks before the story ran, and found that she was still extremely reluctant to talk to me. She was unsure. She considered it. She kept saying, "Call me back later this afternoon." I had wanted to fly out to Oklahoma to talk to her. She was just the image of a woman tortured by this decision, quite contrary to the image that many people have gotten of someone who was out to get Clarence Thomas.
And just to clarify, when you did call her to try to talk about it, this was after you had gotten confirmation from a second source that she had these complaints, and that way you felt you could call her without going against your agreement with the first source.
That's right. That's right.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Timothy Phelps, author of the new book Capital Games, Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill, and the Story of a Supreme Court Nomination. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Timothy Phelps is my guest. He covers the Supreme Court for New York Newsday, and he broke the story of Anita Hill. When you heard rumors that Thomas had sexually harassed employees, why did you decide to pursue that? Why did you think that this might be something more than just a rumor?
Fairly early on in looking into Clarence Thomas, I became convinced that there was another side to this man. So many of his friends described him as extremely outgoing and extremely jovial and friendly. He certainly had a magnetic personality to some individuals. But I kept coming across things that did not square with that image. He had fired a couple of employees or attempted to transfer them or demote them simply for speaking about problems at the agency to the press. Some of the employees had been fired by having a note taped to their chair. At the same time, I began hearing about connections between Clarence Thomas and a man named Jay Parker, a ultra conservative black PR man in Washington, who had been a lobbyist for South Africa or various South African organizations for some 10 years, and this turned out to be Clarence Thomas's closest friend and his real, true political mentor. And so I seemed all the time to be dealing with two people, one of them a wonderful, outgoing, jovial man who befriended the people who worked for him, and the other a very angry man and somewhat vindictive. So perhaps because of those two conflicting images, when I heard about the allegations of sexual harassment, which at that point were just a rumor, I was better predisposed to take them seriously and to look into them.
As a reporter, you were getting a lot of information, as were many other reporters as well, about Clarence Thomas as someone who you perceived as an ideologue. Yet, when he was being questioned at the hearings, that's mm-hmm. not the way he would answer questions. So what were some of the dilemmas that you faced as a reporter during the hearings when you were reporting on Thomas's testimony?
Well, it was a very difficult situation. I actually tried to go back and write a story during the hearings about Clarence Thomas as an ideologue. And the editors would say, well, look, I mean, this doesn't square with what he's saying in the hearings. There was a very successful maneuver by Clarence Thomas and his White House handlers to portray himself as something different than what he had become. And when in the course of doing the research for the book, this puzzle kind of cleared itself up. We put everything he had said and written literally on a timeline. And there you could see the curve, you could see the change. Because when Clarence Thomas first came to Washington, he was truly a moderate conservative. In fact, he got into trouble with the conservative wing of the Republican Party for not working fast enough to dismantle affirmative action. He was almost fired. And perhaps because of that, he kind of began to change his tune. And then later in the process, changed his tune very dramatically. So what seemed like a contradiction between the Clarence Thomas of 1982, 1983, and the Clarence Thomas of later years became more understandable as we put it on this timeline.
On that weekend of the Anita Hill portion of the Clarence Thomas hearings, on Sunday, both Hill and Thomas had panels of witnesses who testified on their behalf. But Anita Hill only had one panel of witnesses, whereas Clarence Thomas had several. And, I mean, there were so many Clarence Thomas witnesses, it extended into prime time, beyond prime time, late into the night. What happened to the rest of the Anita Hill witnesses? How come they never testified?
All through this process, terrible mistakes were being made by the Democratic side and the Hill forces, while the Republicans were extremely adept and astute at getting their message across. Anita Hill had a second panel of witnesses prepared to testify, but the Hill camp itself decided to call them off. First, they made a terrible miscalculation that they were winning this battle, both in the Senate and in the polls. After Anita Hill's first panel of witnesses testified that she had told them about sexual harassment years before, and after Hill's announcement that she had taken a polygraph test and had passed, the Hill camp said, "Well, we're ahead. We don't need to do this." There were problems with their second panel. There were indications that the Republicans, who were really playing hardball at this point, were going to ask personal questions to members of the panel that would embarrass them.
What kinds of personal questions?
Well, about perhaps sexual orientation, other kinds of questions about their awareness of what process had taken place in terms of releasing the story to the press. There were just questions that they didn't want to face. Alan Simpson had been flapping his coat saying, "I'm getting things over the transom." And they decided that they were ahead and they didn't need to go through that process. Of course, they were wrong.
Do you think the witnesses wouldn't have been able to hold their own against those questions?
Oh, I think perhaps they would have, and I think they would have helped. The other witness who was not called, and this was a decision of the Judiciary Committee, was Angela Wright, the other woman who was prepared to testify that she too had been sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas. She's a newspaper editor in North Carolina, and she had somewhat similar experiences while working for Clarence Thomas shortly after Anita Hill left the EEOC. And she even had a backup witness of her own, an older lady named Rose Jordan, who had worked with both of them and was prepared to say that, yes, Angela Wright had come into my office in tears after leaving the chairman's office because of what he had said to her. The Democrats never called the two of them. The reason, as near as we could find, was that they'd been kind of bamboozled by the Republicans into thinking that there was something wrong with Angela Wright. Alan Simpson was going around saying, "I've got the goods on her."
What happens if some time down the line it's discovered, this is hypothetical, it's discovered that the allegations of sexual harassment against Clarence Thomas were true? What would happen?
Well, I asked Senator Spector this question on Nightline a few days after Justice Thomas was confirmed, and he said that that he thought that impeachment would be possible. There is some debate among constitutional scholars as to whether or not you can impeach a justice for something he did before he went on the Supreme Court. And some say yes and some say no. But I think that the Senate itself would be so outraged if it was proven that these charges were true that that there certainly would be a move in that direction.
I wonder if you know if there are still people investigating the charges against Clarence Thomas.
Well, I certainly am. I know of...
You still are?
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm not on any vendetta here, and I don't intend to write a lot of stories out of this investigation, but I think that it's the responsibility of the press to find out what happened. I mean, after all, either a justice of the Supreme Court committed perjury in order to get there, or a unprecedented illegal campaign to sabotage this nomination took place, including an awful lot of perjury. So I think that this is something that we can't let lie.
It must be very hard to investigate someone who was a Supreme Court justice.
Well, I think it was very difficult to investigate even someone who was nominated,
yeah.
Because so many people felt that all the power and wrath of Washington would come down on them if they talked, and certainly it would even be heightened now. But I'm hopeful that over time, as things quiet down, that sources who may know the truth will come forward, or at least be more willing to talk.
Timothy Phelps covers the Supreme Court for New York Newsday. His new book about the Clarence Thomas appointment is Capital Games. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.